After taking Claiborne's buggy down to Amos Hillman's livery stable, Frank talked the mining engineer into spending the night at his house, since he planned to sleep on the cot in the marshal's office anyway. Early the next morning, with Catamount Jack taking over as deputy, Frank saddled up Goldie and got ready to ride out to the Crown Royal with Claiborne. In the stall across the aisle, Stormy tossed his head angrily when he saw Frank leading out the other horse.
Oh, don't worry, fella. You're not being replaced. I just want to see how Goldie here acts on the trail.
Goldie's injuries were mostly healed, and the gelding acted eager to stretch his legs. Wolf came along too, trotting alongside the horse as Frank rode over to the cafe, where he had arranged to meet Garrett Claiborne. As he got there, Claiborne came out of the building, followed by Becky Humphreys, who was wiping her hands on her apron. Pretty, red-headed Becky was the youngest of the three women who ran the cafe.
Y'all come back to see us any time, Mr. Claiborne.
I'll do that, Miss Humphreys. I must say those biscuits were some of the best I've ever eaten.
Oh, go on with you, you flatterer.
Ready to go, Marshal?
Yep. Amos has got your buggy horse harnessed up and waiting for you.
I'll be right back, then.
Morning, Marshal. I like that new friend of yours.
He seems like a decent sort. I didn't know you were a Southern girl.
Why, I suspect there's a whole heap of things you don't know about little old me, Marshal.
Frank beamed a dry grin. Becky was used to playing up to men. It was sort of an occupational habit with her. She had probably gotten Claiborne to admit that he was from Georgia, and that was all it took for Becky to transform herself into a Southern belle. The thing of it was, Frank didn't know if he wanted Becky flirting with Claiborne or not. He had hoped to distract Diana Woodford with the mining man, and if Claiborne got mixed up with Becky, then Frank would be right back where he started with Diana. He supposed he could let it drop to Claiborne that Becky used to be a whore, but as soon as the thought crossed his mind, Frank discarded it and scolded himself for even thinking such a thing. He liked Becky, and her partners, Lauren and Ginny, too, for that matter, and didn't want to embarrass them. A man his age shouldn't still have to be worrying about romance and such like, he told himself. He ought to be past all that. Dealing with gunmen and outlaws and killers was a mite easier most of the time. Claiborne rattled up in the buggy. Becky waved goodbye as Frank and Claiborne headed out of town.
You seem to have an abundance of attractive young women in Buckskin, Marshal. Miss Humphreys and the other two ladies in the cafe, and of course Miss Woodford.
I hate to break it to you, Mr. Claiborne, but with those four, you've already met all the eligible females in Buckskin. Trudy Benjamin, who runs the boarding house, is married. You met her husband Leo at the general store yesterday?
Oh, yes, of course.
Well, they're the only women in town. Well, for now, anyway. I'd be surprised if more don't show up soon, though. You've been around boomtowns before, though you know what I mean.
Yes, I certainly do.
A decade earlier, when the Crown Royal was still operating, a decent road had run between the mine and the settlement. Over the years, nature had reclaimed some of the road until it was now just a narrow trail. Claiborne had trouble negotiating some of it in the budget.
We're going to have to improve this route. We'll be bringing wagon loads of ore over this trail.
Assuming there are wagon loads of ore still to be found.
Yes, of course. But I have a feeling there will be.
Frank hoped Claiborne was right, not so much for his own sake, but for Conrad's, and also for the town's. With several successful mines operating in the vicinity, Buckskin might grow into a fine city. A short time later, they rounded a bend in the trail, and the landscape sprawled out in front of them in an impressive panorama of wooded hills, lush valleys, and stark, snow-capped mountains looming over all of it.
Ah, this is beautiful country. And quite rugged and uncivilized, of course, but still beautiful.
It's not as uncivilized as you might think. If it was, we'd have to worry about Paiutes lifting our hair right now. It wasn't all that many years ago such things were still going on. Now, though, all the Indians have been pacified. The grizzly bears and the cougars have retreated up higher into the mountains, and even the diamondback rattlers aren't as common as they used to be. Nah, the only real danger you're liable to run into now comes from outlaws.
There are still outlaws in this area?
There are outlaws anywhere you go, if there are people there. It's human nature for some folks to be downright ornery and crooked.
I suppose. There! Is that the mine?
I believe it is.
They arrived at the Crown Royal a few minutes later. Frank was surprised to see that several buildings were still standing, including a large one where the narrow-gauge railroad tracks that emerged from the hole in the side of the hill terminated. That was the stamp mill, where the ore brought out of the mine in carts was pulverized so the silver could be separated out from the worthless rock. The mine superintendent had probably had his office in there, too. Nearby was a long, low building that must have served as the barracks for the miners. There was also a cook shack, a mess hall, and several storage sheds. Frank guessed that was what those buildings had been used for, anyway.
Well, this is quite impressive. Everything appears to be in better shape than I thought it would be. I'll have to take a closer look to be sure, of course.
Let's go take that look.
Claiborne climbed out of the buggy and headed straight for the mine entrance.
I want to check the shoring timbers in the shaft.
Frank and Wolf followed him. After a second, Wolf bounded ahead and darted toward the black opening in the hillside.
Probably smelled a rabbit in there.
What if it's one of those grizzly bears or mountain lions you mentioned?
Wolf's got more sense than to charge into a hole that's got a grizz or cougar in it. Damn it! Wolf! Wolf! Get out of there!
Good Lord! The noise must have set off a cave-in!
To Frank's great relief, Wolf darted back into sight at the mine entrance, racing out of the black shaft as a cloud of dust boiled from the opening behind him.
Oh, the timbers must have been practically rotted away. There's no telling how much damage was done.
Sorry. To tell you the truth, I never even thought about the old fella causing a cave-in.
Oh, it's all right. I suppose, in a way, it's a blessing. The most unstable parts of the shaft will have already collapsed, and now it won't be quite as dangerous when we go in there to dig it out and shore up the rest of the tunnels.
You hear that, boy? Good job.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but this is certainly not an insurmountable obstacle.
They spent the next hour examining the shaft and the buildings. Frank felt a twinge of nervousness when he stepped into the hole in the hillside, but Claiborne looked at the thick timbers supporting the roof and told him it was safe enough. Still, Frank was glad to be back in the open air. Most of the machinery in the stamp mill had been dismantled and hauled away when the mine was closed down before.
Well, that's all right. We'll bring in more modern equipment and do an even better job now. There have been great improvements in the pulverization and amalgamation processes in the past 10 years.
That's good to hear, even though I don't really know what you're talking about. But if Conrad Browning has faith in you, Garrett, then so do I.
Well, I won't let you and Mr. Browning down, Marshal. I don't see why we can't have this mine up and running in a month. Maybe less, depending on how many workers we're able to hire. The initial expenditure will be fairly high, but the Browning Mining Syndicate can afford it. I've seen the assay reports on the ore coming out of the Lucky Lizard now, and if we can approach the same quality here, the Crown Royal should be a lucrative venture once again.
Well, whatever I can do to help you, just let me know. Most of my time is spent keeping the peace in town, of course, but I'll be glad to lend a hand out here as much as I can.
Marshal, can I be blunt?
Sure.
What I really need is for you to just stand back and let me get to work.
I reckon I can do that.
On their way back to Buckskin, Frank and Garrett Claiborne had to pass fairly close to the Alhambra mine.
As long as we're in the vicinity, want to look over the Alhambra mine?
Well, we might as well. Just a quick look, though. I'm not sure it would be ethical to do too thorough an inspection of it since it's owned by a competitor.
That's a good point. Shouldn't hurt anything to have a glance around, though.
Frank found the trail that veered off toward the other mine, and he and Claiborne followed it for the next quarter of an hour as it ran around rugged hills and along spiny ridges. They came to a shelf of land that jutted out from a gray cliff that rose almost straight up for a couple of 100 feet. Several squarish towers of rock stuck up from the top of the cliff like battlements on a castle or fortress. They were natural formations, but they had a striking man-made look about them.
Well, I can see how the mine got its name. The original owner must have been a world traveler. That cliff bears a distinct resemblance to the Spanish palace known as the Alhambra.
I wouldn't know about that, since I've never been there myself. But I'll take your word for it, Garrett.
Frank reined in when they were still about 50 yards from a group of ramshackle buildings and the black mouth of a mine shaft in the hillside. From the looks of things, the Alhambra was in worse shape than the Crown Royal. Claiborne brought the buggy to a halt beside Frank.
Well, I don't see any signs of life. Monroe's men must not have gotten here yet.
You sure this fella Monroe's gonna open up this mine again?
Well, the mining industry is like any other business, Marshal. It's full of rumors, and everyone tries to keep up with everyone else's activities. But from everything I've heard, Hamish Monroe has high hopes for this.
Get down!
Frank had seen a telltale glint of sunlight on metal just inside at one of the windows in the old mill building. So he kicked his feet from the stirrups, leaped from the saddle, landed in the buggy, grabbed Claiborne, and dived out the other side of the vehicle, dragging the startled engineer with him. As they sprawled on the rocky earth, a rifle cracked and sent a bullet whistling through the space where Claiborne had been a few seconds earlier. Frank's instincts had been right again. There was a bushwhacker lurking in the old stamp mill. Frank surged to his feet with one hand hooked in Claiborne's collar. He hauled the smaller man upright and hustled him around to the rear of the buggy. They ducked behind the buggy as another shot ricocheted off some of its brass trim. The horse, hitched to the front of the buggy, moved around skittishly.
Oh my God, why are they shooting at us?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Frank drew his Colt as he crouched there. The shots paused for a moment, probably so the bushwhacker could reload.
Hey, you in the mill! Hold your fire, blast it! We don't mean you any harm!
The only reply was a resumption of the shooting. Bullets tore through the canvas canopy over the buggy's seat.
Wolf, go get it!
Wolf took off running toward the mill. His powerful muscles bunched under his shaggy hide as he raced over the ground. Bullets plowed into the dirt around him, but he darted from side to side so that, as fast as he was moving, he was an almost impossible target to hit. Wolf disappeared around the back of the mill. His instincts and animal cunning told him to come at the bushwhacker from the rear. Frank just hoped the rifleman was the only one in the old mill. Otherwise, Wolf might be in for a hot lead welcome. Sure enough, a moment later, he heard shots from inside the building.
Stay here and keep your head down.
Frank burst out from behind the buggy and sprinted toward the mill, weaving in his approach as Wolf had done. When he got close to the door, he lifted his foot and slammed his boot heel into the wood just below the knob. Four men were in the room, which at one time must have been an office. One of the men was down on the floor, rolling around, trying to keep a snarling, snapping wolf from ripping his throat out. The other men held guns, but couldn't fire at the big cur for fear of hitting their friend instead.
Look out, Gunther!
A tall, bald, burly man holding a rifle swung toward Frank, but found himself staring down the barrel of the Drifter's peacemaker.
Drop it! Now!
The man called Gunther scowled in anger, but with Frank's gun on him, he had no choice but to bend and place the rifle on the floor at his feet.
Slide it over here. You other men, I want your guns too.
Somebody help me!
The man wrestling with Wolf was already gashed and bloody, his shirt in ribbons from the big cur's sharp, rending teeth.
Wolf!
Instantly, Wolf backed off, but his hackles still stood up menacingly. The other men had pistols in their hands. Since the bushwhacker's shots had come from a rifle, Frank had no doubt that Gunther had been the one firing them. As Frank gave them a cold, level stare, the men put their guns on the floor and kicked them across the room.
You're gonna be damn sorry about this, mister. Threatening us and sicking that damn wolf on us. We'll have the law on you.
He's a dog, not a wolf, and I am the law. Besides, you were the one who came close to killing me and my friend, remember?
I had a right to shoot at you. You're on private property, mister.
That's Marshal to you.
Marshal of Buckskin?
That's right.
You got no authority out here. Your jurisdiction ends at the edge of the settlement.
Technically, he was right. But as the only star packer in this area, Frank figured that as a practical matter, his authority extended a little farther than Buckskin itself. The man Wolf had savaged was helped to his feet by his friends. His injuries looked worse than they really were, Frank knew.
That varmint's loco! Came at me like a hydrophobia skunk! Oh, is he mad, mister? Am I gonna start foaming at the mouth from them bites?
I'm more worried about Wolf coming down with something. Who are you, men?
We work for Hamish Monroe. And in case you don't know, mister, Hamish Monroe is the owner of the Alhambra Mine. That means we belong here, and you're nothing but a damn trespasser. And we got a right to shoot trespassers.
Marshal Morgan, are you all right?
Claiborne! Is that you?
Good Lord! You?
You fellas know each other?
Yes, I know this man, Marshal. He's Gunther Hammersmith. We've encountered each other before. He's also a mining engineer.
And a hell of a lot better one than you'll ever be, Claiborne. Mr. Monroe hired me and my boys to get this mine open and working again. Like I said, we got a right to be here. And you don't.
I haven't seen you around, Buckskin.
Why would we bother going into your two-bit town? We brought our own supplies with us. We've been inspecting the mine and shoring up what needs to be shored up. We don't need to go to Buckskin until we're ready to hire miners. And that won't be for a few days yet.
You got any proof of what you're telling me?
I don't have to show you any proof of anything.
No, but I'm the one holding the gun, and I'm still a mite riled up about those shots you took at us.
All right, all right.
Gunther reached into a hip pocket and took out a folded envelope. He removed a sheet of paper from it, unfolded it, and held it out.
This is a letter from Mr. Monroe authorizing us to be here.
Would you recognize Monroe's signature, Garrett?
Yes, I think so. I've seen it on quite a few documents.
Take a look, then.
Claiborne took the sheet of paper from Hammersmith, being careful not to get in Frank's line of fire, and read the letter.
Well, it's what he said it was, and Mr. Monroe's signature appears to be genuine.
All right. Mr. Claiborne and I will be leaving now. We're going to take your guns with us, though.
You can't do that!
We'll leave them half a mile down the trail. That way, we'll already be gone by the time you get them back. And you won't be tempted to take any more shots at us.
This ain't right. It ain't legal.
If you want to file a formal complaint, you can ride into Buckskin and do so.
Hammersmith glared, but didn't say anything else. Claiborne gathered up the guns, and staggering a little under the weight of all the hardware, carried them back to the buggy. Frank backed out of the office, keeping his Colt trained on the open door. Frank was thankful when the horse came trotting up to him. Obviously, one of his prior owners had trained the horse. With practiced ease, Frank swung up into the saddle using only his left hand to grip the horn. His right was still filled with the butt of the peacemaker. He waited until Claiborne had climbed into the buggy, turned it around, and sent it rolling along the trail at a quick pace before he turned Goldie around and rode away as well. Wolf loped alongside, tongue lolling from his mouth, obviously pleased with himself. Frank glanced over his shoulder several times, just in case Hammersmith and the others had more guns hidden somewhere in the mill. But by the time he and Claiborne were out of sight of the mine, they hadn't emerged from the building. Frank called a halt half a mile down the trail, and Claiborne dumped the guns out of the buggy as Frank had promised.
I got the feeling you and that fella Gunther don't like each other very much.
Gunther Hammersmith is a brute. He's the sort of man who thinks he has to enforce his will on the men working for him by means of fear and violence. He's beaten a couple of men to death when they stood up to him. Last time was at a mine in Colorado. He was fired as superintendent and I was brought in to take his place. He's hated me ever since. I think he believes that I was responsible for him being discharged from the job.
If he beat a man to death, why wasn't he put in jail instead of being fired?
Well, the man who owned the mine had a considerable amount of influence. Some of the other miners swore that the man Hammersmith killed attacked him first. The Hammersmith claimed he was just defending himself. Everyone was too afraid of him to contradict his story.
Sounds like the sort of gent this Hamish Monroe would hire, if he's as ruthless as you say he is.
Yes. Monroe and Hammersmith certainly make a good match.
Hammersmith has worked for Monroe before, and I'm not surprised to see that he's the one Monroe picked up to supervise the Alhambra's operation. This is going to complicate the situation, especially for you, Marshal.
You're saying that I'm going to have trouble with him when he comes into Buckskin?
After today, with the grudge that he's bound to hold against you, I'd say you can count on it.
Frank and Claiborne didn't run into any more trouble on their way back to the settlement. By the time they reached Buckskin, it was early afternoon. Claiborne still hadn't met Tip Woodford, so when they passed the rotund, overall-clad mayor on the street, Frank reined in, hailed him, and motioned him over.
Tip, I'd like for you to meet Garrett Claiborne.
Yeah, you're the mining engineer, come to take over the Crown Royal. My gal told me about you coming into the office. Put her there, Claiborne. Glad to meet you.
Well, I must say, that's a friendly greeting, considering that we're competitors, Mr. Woodford. The pleasure is mine.
I don't see us as competitors. I got my claim, and the folks who own the Crown Royal got theirs. I'm hoping there's plenty of silver in the hills to go around for all of us.
Well, that's my hope as well.
Diana said for me to invite you to supper tonight if I happen to run into you. And you too, Marshal.
Well, that's very considerate of you and your daughter, sir, but...
We'll be there.
Great. See you boys later.
Well, I had hoped to get started lining up workers for the mine.
You'll still have time this afternoon to do that. Start at the Silver Baron Saloon. It's Tip's place, but all the prospectors show up there sooner or later. And Tip won't mind you doing a little recruiting in there.
All right. I'll take your advice, Marshal.
Frank gave Claiborne directions for finding the Woodford house in case they didn't run into each other again before it was time to go there for supper, then headed for the marshal's office after putting up his horse at Hillman's livery. He wondered if he ought to tell Claiborne that he was part owner of the Crown Royal. Obviously, Conrad hadn't seen fit to share that information with the mining engineer, so Frank decided he would follow his son's lead. The door to the marshal's office was jerked open just before Frank got there, and Catamount Jack came out carrying a shotgun. A grim look was on the old-timer's face, and Frank knew right away there was trouble.
Marshal, glad you're back.
What's going on, Jack?
A fella come by just a minute ago and said a bad ruckus was about to break out down in one of them new whiskey palaces. Kelly's top-notch, I think he said. I was about to go see about it.
I'll take care of it.
You want the greener?
No, that's all right. If I need a gun, I've always got my Colt.
I reckon that's usually been plenty for you, ain't it, Marshal?
I guess.
As Frank strode away from the marshal's office, he recalled that Kelly's top-notch saloon, which had been in operation for a little over a week, was a hole-in-the-wall place around a corner, facing one of Buckskin's side streets instead of the main street. Hardly a palace, as Jack had described it. As Frank's long legs carried him around that corner, he heard a sudden crash from inside the saloon. Frank broke into a run and slapped the bat wings aside. The top notch was a long, narrow room with the bar on the right, a scattering of tables on the left, and a big pot-bellied stove that was cold at the moment in the rear of the room. One of the tables had been knocked over, and the chairs around it upset. Playing cards were strewn around on the floor. That was enough to convince Frank that the fight now going on had its origins in a poker game gone bad. A burly hombre wearing work boots, overalls, and a flannel shirt was trading punches with a slightly smaller man whose suit and fancy cravat marked him as a gambler. The professional card player was no effete fop, though. He was standing toe-to-toe with the miner and slugging it out. Both men had bruises on their faces already. A bartender with a turkey neck and no chin stood behind the hardwood, watching the battle with a worried, pop-eyed expression. Two other men, both dressed like prospectors, stood back on the other side of the room, also intent spectators to the fisticuffs.
Hey, break it up, you two!
The battlers ignored him and continued to swing wild, looping punches. Most of the blows missed, which was a good thing. If they had all connected, the men might have done some serious damage to themselves by now. Frank moved toward the two men. As the tides of battle made them sway closer to him, Frank reached out and caught hold of the miner's collar. He hauled back hard and flung the surprised man toward the bar. The gambler had just thrown a punch that missed because Frank pulled the miner out of its path. He stumbled forward, off balance, and Frank caught hold of his arm to keep him from falling.
What in the hell you think you... Look out!
Frank let go of the gambler and twisted around to see the miner lunging at him and swinging a bottle of whiskey he had snatched up off the bar. It slammed into his left shoulder instead and sent pain shooting through Frank's body. Not the left arm, though. It went numb. Frank hooked a hard right into the miner's belly. The blow had enough power behind it to knock the man back a step. Still using his right fist because his left arm was useless for the moment, Frank clubbed the miner on the left side of the head, just above the ear. That staggered the man, but didn't put him down. He dropped the bottle, caught himself, and lunged forward, tackling Frank around the waist. The miner was heavier than Frank and bore him backward. Frank tripped on some of the debris from the broken table and fell backward. He crashed to the floor, and the miner's weight came down on him with stunning force. Ham-like hands fastened around his neck, the fingers digging in with cruel force as they cut off his air. Since the hard landing had already knocked the breath out of him, Frank didn't have any air in reserve. He knew he would pass out in a matter of seconds, so he had to do something fast. He clawed at his holster, intending to draw the Colt and slam it against his attacker's head. But the holster was empty. The gun had fallen out sometime during the struggle, probably when Frank was knocked off his feet. The miner slumped to the side, falling off Frank. With the weight gone, Frank's chest heaved as he dragged life-giving breaths of air into his lungs again. He looked over and saw the miner sprawled on the floor beside him, out cold. Blood trickled from a cut in the man's thick brown hair and ran down the side of his face. Somebody had clouted him a couple of good ones. It had taken two blows to knock him out, and when Frank glanced up, he wasn't surprised to see the gambler standing there with a broken table leg clutched in his hand.
Let me help you up, Marshal.
You could have killed him, you know. Hitting him with the table leg like that.
Not very damn likely. Bastard's got a skull made out of iron, and it's thick, too. Anyway, if somebody had to die, I figured he was a better choice than Buckskin's Marshal.
Can't argue with that. Oh, I'm obliged to you.
Hell, the only reason you got mixed up in this fracas was because you tried to keep him from busting up me and my place any worse than he already had. I'm Ed Kelly, with two E's. I own the saloon.
Kelly was about 35, with broad shoulders, thick dark hair, and a narrow mustache.
What started this ruckus?
The usual misunderstanding. Rogan thought I was cheating because I won a big pot from him.
Were you?
I guess being a lawman, you have to ask that question, eh?
I like to know what's going on in my town.
Well, in the interests of full disclosure, no, I wasn't cheating, Marshal. I don't have to cheat to win. Rogan is a reckless, impulsive player. I could clean him out any day of the week without half trying.
All right, that's pretty much the answer I was expecting. So I'll take your word for it, Kelly. Just make sure you continue to run clean games here.
That's what I've done every other place I've been.
This fella, Rogan, a friend of yours?
Oh, we worked together at the Lucky Lizard. I wouldn't say we were his friends.
Well, pick him up anyway and haul him down to the jail for me.
We ain't your deputies that you can boss around, Marshal.
No, but you work for me. And if you want to keep on working for me, you'll do what the Marshal asks.
The two men did as they were told, lifting the still unconscious Rogan and carrying him out of the saloon.
Tell my deputy to lock him up and keep him there until tomorrow morning. I'm obliged for the helping hand, Tip.
I heard that Rogan was in here raising hell and got over here as soon as I could. Feel like it's sort of my fault since he works for me.
Just because you pay a man wages doesn't make you his keeper.
Maybe not, but Rogan ain't gonna be gambling away any more money I pay him, because as soon as he comes to, I'm firing him. He's been a troublemaker from the start, always complaining, trying to stir up the men against me. I pay him decent wages and treat him decent, too. I don't need somebody like Dave Rogan around causing an uproar for no good reason.
I hope you don't attach any blame to me for what happened, Mr. Woodford. We haven't met. I'm Ed Kelly.
No, I don't blame you, Kelly. Ain't your fault that Rogan's an ornery bastard.
Well, you own the Silver Baron Saloon as well as that mine, don't you?
That's right.
Biggest saloon in Buckskin, or so I've heard. Haven't checked it out for myself yet.
Stop by any time and have a drink on me.
I'll do that. Now, if you'll excuse me, gentlemen, I'd like to go clean up. Get this mess straightened up in here.
Right away, boss.
You've had a mighty busy day. Trouble every which way you look, seems like.
That's what life is like in a boomtown.
I got that fella locked up back yonder in one of the cells.
That's fine. You can let him out in the morning if you're here. If not, I'll take care of it.
Gonna fine him for trying to kill you?
I probably ought to. But he lost all his money to Ed Kelly at the Top Notch. That's what he was so upset about. I reckon spending a night in jail will have to be punishment enough for him. That and losing his job, because Tip's gonna fire him for causing another ruckus.
Well, serves him right. We don't have to feed him, do we? Can't we at least let him go hungry tonight?
That wouldn't be humane. I'll talk to the ladies over at the cafe, see if they can bring a tray over to him. And one for you, too.
See if that gal Ginny can bring it over. I think she likes me a mite.
Frank tried not to grin. Plump, blonde Ginny Carlson liked most men. It was in her nature. It was a wonder that being a soiled dove for several years and dealing with them on a regular basis hadn't soured her on the entire male population, but it hadn't.
I'll see what I can do.
Rogan stirred on the bunk where he had been placed, but he wasn't fully conscious yet. Frank wondered if he ought to have Professor Burton take a look at Rogan, since the professor was the closest thing Buckskin had to a doctor. Frank hoped that Ed Kelly hadn't cracked Rogan's skull with that table leg.
Oh, God damn it. Shit. Oh, son of a bitch, what the shit hit me?
Frank decided he was all right after all. Probably just had one hell of a headache. Maybe a night in jail would help cure Rogan of that.
See you later.
Frank went over to the cafe, which wasn't busy at the moment because the midday rush was over and it wasn't time for supper yet. In fact, Lauren Stillman was the only person there. Older than Becky and Jenny, she was in her early 30s. Rather than being classically beautiful, she was what some people called a handsome woman. The thick brown hair that fell around her shoulders softened her looks somewhat.
Hello, Marshall. What can I do for you?
Hello, Lauren. Could you arrange for a couple of meals for Catamount Jack and for my prisoner at the jail? And if you don't mind, could Ginger take him over?
Can do. Say, I heard about that fight you had with Dave Rogan.
Word's gotten around already?
Mm-hmm. Buckskin is a small town. Everybody knows everybody else's business. For example, I know that you're having dinner with Diana Woodford tonight.
Well, not just with Diana. Her pa'll be there, too. As well as that new mining engineer, Garrett Claiborne.
Yes, but the only one Diana is really interested in is you. Now, surely I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, Frank. Like I said, in a small town, everybody knows everybody else's business.
There's no business involving me and Diana Woodford.
That's not because she wouldn't like for there to be.
Diana's wasting her time. A young woman like her needs to find herself a more suitable fella. Somebody a whole lot younger than me.
With people like us, it's not the years so much as it is the miles.
That's the truth. If you'll see that those meals get sent over to the jail.
Of course. Don't worry about it, Marshall.
I'll pay you for them.
No need. I'll bill the mayor. It's the town's responsibility to feed the prisoners, not yours.
You sure?
Positive.
All right, then. Be seeing you.
Jack had been stuck in the office most of the day, so Frank relieved him for a while, giving the old-timer a chance to go back to his cabin and check on El Dorado, the rangy mule that had accompanied Jack on numerous prospecting trips. El Dorado was semi-retired now, as was Jack himself. A man never really got the lure of gold and silver out of his veins, but some of them learned to live with it. Jack had, and he didn't want to go prospecting anymore. At least, that was what he claimed. When Jack got back to the office, Frank walked over to the small cabin the town was providing for his residence. Claiborne was inside, shaving and cleaning up.
I just thought I should make myself presentable.
Good idea.
Since Claiborne had a fire going in the stove, Frank heated some water for himself and got his razor out. As dusk settled down over the rugged Nevada countryside, the two men walked toward the Woodford house, both of them freshly shaven and smelling of bay rum. Tip and Diana lived in the largest house in town, built with the proceeds from the first strike at the Lucky Lizard mine more than a decade earlier. During the years Tip had lived there alone, after his wife left him and moved back east, taking Diana with her, he had allowed the house to deteriorate quite a bit. When Diana returned, she had taken one look at the place, rolled up her sleeves, and started in on the task of cleaning it up and fixing it up. She had done a good job. The Woodford place was once again the nicest home in town. The picket fence in front had a fresh coat of whitewash on it, as did the walls of the two-story house itself. The flower beds had all the weeds pulled out of them, and flagstones had been carefully placed to make a walk leading to the front porch steps. The windows were all clean and glowed with warm yellow light from the lamps inside, filtering through the curtains Diana had hung over them.
What a lovely home.
You can give Diana credit for that. An old pelican like Tip would just as soon live in a tent or a shack. Diana's the one who fixed the place up. Yes, sir, she'll make some lucky man a fine wife one of these days.
Indeed.
Hello, gentlemen. Come right in.
Diana wore a pale blue dress that went well with her blue eyes, fair skin, and blonde hair. This was one of the few times Frank had seen her when she wasn't wearing boots and jeans and a man's shirt. This evening, she looked utterly feminine, and so lovely she'd almost take a fella's breath away.
Thank you, Miss Woodford. And thank you for inviting us to dinner.
We want to make you feel welcome in Buckskin, Mr. Claiborne. Let me take your hat, Marshal.
Frank handed her his high-crowned Stetson. She took Claiborne's bowler hat, too, but seemingly as an afterthought. Tip came down the stairs and joined them in the foyer. He wore a dusty brown tweed suit. His shirt had a stiff collar, and there was a tie around his neck. He dug a finger under his collar and tugged on it.
Howdy.
Father, I told you stop messing with your collar. It's not going to kill you to dress like a civilized person for a change.
It might. This here collar's liable to choke me to death.
Look at how nicely Mr. Claiborne's dressed, and he doesn't seem to mind.
Yeah, I reckon he's more used to it than I am. Come on in the parlor, boys, and we'll have a snort before dinner.
I'll go check on the food.
Tip led Frank and Claiborne into a comfortably furnished parlor and poured drinks for all three of them from a crystal decanter.
Well, you have a lovely home here, Mr. Woodford, and your daughter is quite lovely, too.
Yeah, well, most of the time she's pretty down to earth, but she likes to put on airs every now and then. I reckon the way she was brought up had something to do with that. No offense to Diana's ma, God rest her poor soul, but my wife could be a mite prissy when she wanted to. Diana's been a lot happier here in Buckskin than I thought she'd be when she came out here to live with me.
It must have been difficult for her, losing her mother like that. I find her strength quite admirable.
So do I. She's a fine young woman.
We can stand here gabbing about Diana all night, or we can talk about the mines. How'd the Crown Royal look to you, Claiborne? Oh, hell, don't worry. I ain't planning on trying to jump your claim. It'll be fine with me if the Crown Royal's a success again, because that'll be good for the town.
Oh, well, in that case, I don't mind telling you that I think opening the mine again won't pose too much of a problem. There'll be plenty of hard work that needs to be done, of course, but if I can hire some good men, we can meet the challenge.
I know one man you can hire. Name a Rogan.
Wouldn't be a good idea. The hombre's a troublemaker.
Oh, hell, I was just joshing. I wouldn't have let the young fella hire Rogan, but I sure shooting fired him. Went by the jail and talked to him just a little while ago. Told him he was through at the Lucky Lizard.
How'd he take it?
Not good. Grabbed the bars and rattled them while he was cussing at me. He didn't settle down until old Catamount Jack stuck a greener in his face and warned him he wouldn't get no supper unless he stopped carrying on so.
Well, yeah, he does sound like a troublemaker. I hope all the men in Buckskin aren't like that.
Not hardly. I'll give you a hand finding some fellows who want to work.
Dinner's ready.
It was good, too. Fried chicken, greens, and potatoes out of the garden patch behind the house, and biscuits and gravy. Frank praised the food, which made Diana blush with pleasure, but the words were more for Claiborne's benefit. He wanted to make sure the mining engineer understood just what a fine catch Diana would be. Claiborne was shy, and even though he could be glib enough when he did speak, he kept his mouth shut most of the time, no matter how much Frank tried to get him and Diana to talking. Still, she seemed to like Claiborne well enough, so Frank was a little encouraged. When it came time for them to go, though, after the men retreated to the parlor for some brandy and cigars, Diana was waiting on the porch to bid them good night. She lingered the longest on her farewell to Frank, putting her hand on his arm.
Please come back any time, Marshall.
Yes, ma'am.
It was a wonderful evening, Miss Woodford. The food was delicious, and, well, no man could complain about the company.
How sweet of you. Good evening, Mr. Claiborne.
Miss Woodford really is a fine young woman. You're a fortunate man, Marshall.
Me? Why me?
Obviously, she's fond of you. I believe she set her cap for you.
I'm old enough to be her father, blast it. She needs somebody younger. Like you.
Me? Why, I would never dream of interfering with someone else's romance.
There's no romance to interfere with.
Well, perhaps not in your mind. But in the young ladies, who knows? And when it comes to matters of the heart, Marshall, we both know that as men, we don't really have all that much say in the matter now, do we?
That was true, unfortunately, Frank thought with a frown. But he had planted the seed anyway, he hoped, and maybe someday it would grow into something. Frank let Dave Rogan out of the jail cell early the next morning.
You're gonna be sorry for locking me up, Marshall. And that bastard Kelly's gonna wish I'd never set foot in his place.
I'd say there's a good chance Kelly already feels that way. Listen to me, mister. If you start any more trouble in Buckskin, you're liable to get a lot worse than you got this time. I won't stand for it, you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Then you'd better remember what I said. Rogan, since you don't have a job anymore, maybe it'd be a good thing for you to move on. Find something somewhere else.
Are you running me out of town?
I'm just saying that it might be wise to move on.
I like it here.
Frank had a feeling that he hadn't seen the last of Rogan, nor the last of any trouble caused by the man. As the days passed, though, Rogan didn't show his face in Buckskin, and for the most part, things in the settlement were quiet and peaceful. With the help of Frank and Tip Woodford, Claiborne found half a dozen men who were tired of prospecting and not finding any silver, and willing to go to work for the Crown Royal. When Frank rode out to the mine to check on how they were doing, he saw the men working to clean out, shore up, and extend the shaft. They were hard workers, Claiborne reported, and the job of reopening the mine was progressing on schedule, and maybe even a little ahead of schedule. Frank didn't see anything of Gunther Hammersmith, although he heard that the superintendent of the Alhambra had been in town looking for workers, too. That was Hammersmith's right, Frank supposed. After their run-in at the mine, he didn't like the man, but as long as Hammersmith didn't break any laws, Frank was prepared to tolerate him. New settlers continued to show up in Buckskin just about every day. Some came on horseback, some in buggies or wagons, some even walked in, carrying all their belongings on their backs. As Frank had been expecting, a madam showed up, bringing four girls with her. They moved into one of the empty houses and set up for business right away, and they certainly didn't lack for customers. Prospectors, who hadn't been with a woman for months, flocked to the place. Some of the more respectable citizens, like Leo and Trudy Benjamin and Professor Burton, disapproved, but Frank knew there was nothing he could do about it. In their own way, the prostitutes provided a valuable service and a civilizing influence. A man who wasn't boiling over with repressed lust was less likely to start trouble in other ways. As a precaution, Frank paid a visit to the madam, who introduced herself as Rosie, and told her that he expected her and her girls to conduct their business in a quiet manner without any problems.
Believe you me, Marshall, nobody wants things to stay peaceful more than we do. Ruckuses are bad for business. Now, before you go, how'd you like to spend some time with one of the gals? On the house, of course.
Frank declined. He had seen too many corrupt star packers who accepted favors and collected graft from the townspeople they were supposed to be serving. He might still be relatively new to the law business, but he was determined to do it the right way. A week after Claiborne's arrival in town, the encounter with Hammersmith, and the trouble with Rogan, Frank was lounging in front of the marshal's office, sitting in a chair that was tipped back against the wall, balancing himself with a booted foot propped against the railing along the front of the boardwalk, when he saw a couple of men riding into town. The front legs of his chair hit the boardwalk as he recognized one of them. He stood up and stepped to the edge of the walk. The two men saw him and angled their horses in his direction. As they reined in, the smaller of the two nodded. He had a broad, friendly face and curly, graying hair under a thumbed-back Stetson. With his sly grin and small stature, Clint Farnham had always reminded Frank a little of a gnome or some sort of creature like that from a children's fairy tale book. Despite his size, he was fast on the draw and a lethal gunman.
Howdy, Frank. It's been a while.
10 years at least, Farnham. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm a mite surprised you didn't say something about how you figured I was dead by now.
I hadn't heard anything about you getting killed. I assumed you're still around. Who's your friend?
This is Charlie Hampton. Wouldn't say that we're friends, but we're riding together for the time being anyway.
You're Frank Morgan?
That's right.
You don't look like much. Hell, you're supposed to be as fast on the draw as Smoke Jensen or Matt Bodine. Maybe even faster.
The Drifter's fast enough to have stayed alive this long, Charlie. How much faster than that does a man have to be?
He won't be alive much longer.
Hampton started to dismount. Frank waited until the man was halfway out of the saddle, with his right foot out of the stirrup and his right leg lifted over the horse's back. Then he palmed out his Colt and leveled it at Hampton.
Hold it right there.
Hampton froze in that awkward position.
What the hell?
That ain't hardly fair, Frank, getting the drop on a man like that.
I don't give a damn about fair. I knew as soon as I saw you fellas ride in that one or both of you were looking for a gunfight.
Farnham held up both hands, palms out toward Frank.
Not me. I've been in my share of showdowns, but I'm not a big enough fool to go up against the Drifter. Charlie here was the one who wanted to test his rep. I'd heard you'd pinned on a badge here in Buckskin, so we moseyed on over to see you.
Damn it, Morgan! How long you expect me to stay here like this?
Until I tell you to move. Nobody asked you to come here and cause trouble.
Looks to me like you're afraid of me, Morgan. Afraid to face me man to man.
Charlie, that wasn't a smart move. But then nobody's ever accused you of being too smart, now have they?
What's going on here, Farnham? You get tired of riding with Hampton or something, so you brought him here to have me kill him for you?
You're the only one who's gonna die, old man.
Might as well get it over with, Frank. Charlie here is a stubborn one. He's not gonna give up or go away until he gets what he wants. A crack at you.
By now, the confrontation had begun to draw some attention from the citizens of Buckskin. Hampton's awkward pose and the gun in Frank's hand caused a murmur of conversation as some of the townspeople started gathering nearby.
You folks move along.
That second, when his attention wasn't on Hampton anymore, was the break the would-be gunfighter had been waiting for. He dived the rest of the way out of the saddle, jerking his revolver from its holster as he tumbled to the street. He rolled over and came up shooting. Frank had already dropped into a crouch and pivoted toward Hampton before the gunslinger could squeeze the trigger, so Hampton's first shot whined harmlessly past his head to thud into the thick log wall of the marshal's office. That was Hampton's first shot and only shot, because in the next heartbeat, Frank's Colt blasted twice. The heavy .45 caliber slugs slammed into Hampton's chest and threw him backward in the street. Frank twisted again, back toward Farnham, Farnum hadn't moved, though, except to lift his hands and hold them in plain sight so that Frank could see right away they were empty.
Don't shoot, Morgan. This was all Charlie's play, not mine. I told him he was a fool to try to take you.
Frank's instincts told him that Farnum spoke the truth. He stepped down off the boardwalk and walked over to where Hampton lay. The gunfighter was on his back, arms and legs splayed out, his revolver lying beside his hand where it had slipped from his nerveless fingers. Frank kicked the gun out of reach, just as a precaution, then towed Hampton's shoulder. The man's head lolled loosely on his shoulders. The glassy look in Hampton's eyes had already told Frank that he was dead, but it never hurt to make sure of these things. The sudden blast of gunshots had made the gathering crowd scurry for cover, but now as silence reigned in Buckskin's main street, their curiosity drove them from their hiding places. Frank replaced the two rounds he had fired with fresh cartridges from the loops on his shell belt, then pouched the iron.
Somebody fetch Langley.
One man hurried off to let the undertaker know what had happened. The others stayed where they were and stared at Hampton's corpse.
Is it all right if I get down off this horse?
Frank made a curt gesture with his hand, indicating that Farnum could dismount. He swung down from the saddle and looped the reins around the hitch rack in front of the boardwalk.
I'm sorry about this, Frank. I know you and I have never been what you'd call friends. But I tried to talk him out of it. He was bound and determined to give it a try, though. He said you were the last really famous gunfighter who's left. And if he ever wanted to make his rep, he'd have to go through you to do it.
Why would a man want a reputation as a gunfighter in this day and age? Men like us are relics, Clint. The West, the way we knew it as youngsters, is getting farther and farther away with each passing day.
True enough. But as long as folks still remember what it used to be like, it's not going to go away completely. There'll always be somebody who wants to try to recapture it. Like him.
Yeah, I reckon you're right.
Frank looked along the street and saw Claude Langley's wagon rolling toward the scene of the shootout.
You plan to stay in Buckskin for long?
Haven't decided yet. I might. Seems like a nice enough little town. It's got a good marshal to enforce law and order.
Come on down to the saloon with me. Least I can do is buy you a drink for old time's sake.
I'm much obliged for your hospitality.
Farnum fell in step beside Frank as they started toward the saloon. Farnum had to take three steps for every two strides that Frank's longer legs made, but Frank didn't slow down to make it easier for him to keep up. They hadn't reached the Silver Baron yet when Frank saw dust boiling up from the trail leading into town.
What the devil?
A moment later, a stagecoach came into view, pulled by a good-looking six-horse hitch. Rather than the red and yellow of a typical Concord coach, this vehicle was painted a dark blue. The side curtains were pulled over the windows to keep the dust out, so Frank couldn't see who was inside as the stagecoach rolled past.
I didn't know Buckskin was on one of the stage lines.
It's not.
And where'd that coach come from? What's it doing here?
I have no idea, but I reckon I'd better find out. We'll have that drink later.
I'll be around.
The stagecoach came to a stop in front of a building that had once been a hotel. Prospectors had moved into the place, taking it over and using it as a rooming house. The man handling the stagecoach's reins was accompanied on the driver's box by another tough-looking hombre holding a Winchester. Both of them climbed down from the box as Frank approached. The driver headed for the back of the coach, while the guard stepped over to the door on the side closest to the boardwalk and opened it. Then he turned toward Frank and brought the rifle's muzzle up. He watched Frank in a somewhat threatening manner.
Take it easy, mister. I'm the law in these parts.
A man climbed out of the coach and stepped down to the street. He wore a dark, expensive suit, and a diamond stick pin sparkled on his cravat. A derby hat perched on his head. He wasn't overly big, but he appeared to have a wiry strength to him.
You're the marshal?
That's right. The name's Frank Morgan.
I own this building. I'll expect you to immediately evict anyone who's living here illegally.
You got proof of that, mister?
Of course. My secretary will provide you with any documentation you need. Right now, I expect you to do your duty, though, and carry out my request so that my companions and I can move in the building without being disturbed.
And just who the hell are you, anyway?
Hamish Monroe. Now hop to it, Marshal.
Somehow, Frank wasn't surprised to learn Hamish Monroe's identity. Everything he'd heard from Garrett Claiborne had indicated that the mining magnate was a thoroughly unpleasant individual, and this dapper stranger certainly fit the bill. Frank had halfway expected Monroe to show up in Buckskin sooner or later.
Here.
Without waiting to see what Frank was going to do, Monroe turned toward the open door of the coach and extended a hand. A woman's arm reached out of the vehicle, and Monroe took her hand. One of the loveliest women Frank had seen in a long time stepped out of the coach and looked around.
So, this is Buckskin.
Frank was a little startled that Monroe would bring such a stunning woman to a rugged Nevada boomtown. The woman was young, no more than 25. She wore a dark blue traveling outfit, the color of which pretty well matched that of the stagecoach. It was an Abbott and Downing coach, Frank noted, the same sort used by most of the stagecoach lines. But Monroe must have purchased it from the company for his personal use and had it repainted and fitted out with lots of fancy silver trim. The horses pulling the coach had that same silver trim on their harnesses. Frank turned his attention back to the young woman. Thick masses of blonde hair, so pale as to be almost white, were piled atop her head, under a neat little blue hat. The dress she wore was tight enough that it clung to the lines of a slender but well-curved body. Her lips were full and red, her eyes gray. She managed to be sensuous and reserved at the same time, not an easy feat. Monroe didn't offer to introduce her. Instead, he took her arm in a smug, possessive manner.
Come along, my dear.
They started toward the doors of the old hotel.
Hold on a minute. There are folks who've been living here, and they're liable to not take kindly to being tossed out on their ears.
As you can well imagine, Marshal, I don't care whether they take kindly to it or not. To use your phrase, this is my building. I intend to use it as my residence and also the local office of my company. Anyone who has been staying here had been doing so unlawfully. I won't press charges against them since they weren't aware of the situation, but I want them out. Now!
Listen here, mister. I don't give a damn who you are or what you own or how much money you have. You talk to me with some respect, or we won't have just gotten off on the wrong foot. We'll stay that way.
All right, then. We understand each other. As the legal owner of this building, I request that you remove the people who have no right to be living in it.
I reckon you have the right to make that request. This is going to be done in an orderly fashion, though. I'm not going to drive people out at gunpoint.
Handle the matter however you see fit, Marshal. Just as long as that official legal request that I made is carried out with a reasonable amount of promptness.
Most of the men who've been staying here won't be in their rooms right now. They're out prospecting or working at one of the mines. I'll get my deputy and we'll go through the place. All the gear in the rooms can be moved over to the marshal's office for now, and its owners can claim it later. Shouldn't take more than an hour or so. That suit you?
And where do you suggest my wife and I wait in the meantime? We've had a long ride and she's tired.
So the blonde was Monroe's wife. Frank had wondered if she was married to the mining magnate, or if she was his daughter, because she was only half of Monroe's age. Obviously, the stagecoach wasn't the only thing he had bought for his personal use. Frank pointed across the street.
There's a nice little cafe over there, and I'm sure the ladies who run it would be glad to serve you some coffee and maybe something to eat if you're hungry.
It has been a long time since we stopped to eat, Hamish.
Very well. Would you mind letting us know when you have the hotel ready for us to occupy, Marshal?
Not at all.
As Monroe and his wife walked toward the cafe, another man got out of the stagecoach. He wore a suit similar to Monroe's, although not as expensive, and a brown hat. About 30, he was handsome in a pale, bland sort of way. He offered a soft hand to Frank.
I'm Nathan Evers, Marshal, Mr. Monroe's confidential secretary. I heard the two of you discussing this hotel, and if you'd like, I can show you the legal documents proving that Mr. Monroe purchased it from the previous owner.
I don't reckon that's necessary. You wouldn't offer to show me the papers unless you really had them. I wonder just how much real estate Monroe's managed to buy here in Buckskin by tracking down the folks who used to own it.
As I mentioned, Marshal, I'm a confidential secretary. I'm afraid I can't discuss such business matters with anyone except Mr. Monroe.
What about his wife?
Mrs. Monroe doesn't concern herself with her husband's financial affairs. Why don't you men unload the bags here on the porch, and I'll let you know when you can bring them on into the hotel.
The men nodded. The driver had already opened the canvas-covered boot at the rear of the coach, so they began taking carpet bags and trunks from it and stacking them on the hotel porch. Frank crossed over to the marshal's office, where the crowd had broken up and folks had gone on about their business once Hampton's corpse had been carted off. Jack had come up while Frank was over at the hotel, and he was leaning on the boardwalk railing.
"What's going on over there at the old hotel? I never seen a stagecoach painted that color before."
"And you probably never will again."
Frank explained about Hamish Monroe's arrival in Buckskin, and added that the mining magnate wanted the squatters cleared out of the hotel.
"Come along, give me a hand with that."
"Sure. I heard you had to kill another fellow who showed up to try and make a name for himself with a fast gun."
"Who told you that?"
"Hombre named Farnum, down to the Silver Baron."
"Keep an eye on him if you happen to run into him again."
"Farnum, you mean? Well, he seems to be a likable, harmless little fella."
"That's what he wants you to think. He's slick on the draw. He's never been overly particular about who he works for or who he rides with. He spent more time on the wrong side of the law than on the right side."
"You don't say. I damn sure will keep an eye on him, Nan."